It's the 26th of September 1916, and the place is Tietvau. Tietvau, that fortress that the Germans had held for 2 years, overlooking the whole of the northern part of the Somme battlefield in every direction. The Germans thought that this position was impregnable. Several attempts had already been made to take it since the 1st of July 1916. The first day of the Battle of the Somme, and they'd all ended in disaster. But here we are now, 26th of September 1916, and everything was to change on that autumn day, because today Tietvau and the Germans defending it were to be attacked using different tactics by the 18th Division, and included within that 18th Division was the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment, my hometown, a town full of cobblers, shoemakers, bootmakers. They'd given up their civilian jobs to volunteer in 1914. Just a few weeks ago, they'd managed to take Trones Wood, another position that the Germans thought would never be taken. But those cobblers, those bootmakers from Northampton and the surrounding villages and towns of Kettering, Wellingborough and Corby had fought the Germans through pure courage and determination, and perhaps most of all because of brilliant leadership. And here they were a few weeks later, turning up at Tietvau. Surely this was going to be a bridge too far, perhaps a fortress too far, but they proved everybody wrong, and they did so without their commanding officer. The divisional commander of the 18th Division was Lieutenant General Sir Ivor Max. And he read a statement the day before the battle. He said the 180th Regiment of the Württembergers have withstood all attempts on Tietvau for 2 years, but the 18th Division will take it tomorrow. He was that confident. And as we now know, he had every right to be confident. Now, at this stage in 1916, all that remained of Tietvau was a pile of bricks where the enormous chateau stood. And the few houses within the village had also been reduced to rubble. The reason why it was so difficult to attack is because it stood on a crest, and still does, of course, overlooking the Unker Valley, and little could be seen from the BEF's entrenched positions down in those valleys. All they could see was the ruins of that old chateau, and of course that made perfect positions for the Germans to set up their machine guns. But what the 18th Division decided to do on that day was not to attack Tietvau front on in a frontal attack. Oh no, they made a flanking attack, just as they'd done on Trones Wood a few weeks before. So before we look at the story through the eyes of the soldiers that were there, let's just look at the plan that they had, the 18th Division, their plan. North Ants, the 6th Battalion, were part of the 54th Brigade, and it lay on the left of the divisional front. The 12th Middlesex were to take the chateau and the redoubt itself and the village, and the 11th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers was to cover the left flank and deal with the obstructing enemy trenches and dugouts. And don't forget, because of the height of this ridge, the Germans had been able to dig enormous dugouts, very deep dugouts, and lots of them as well. The trenches were very deep and strong. The 54th Brigade itself, there was given a front of 300 yards across, and the distance to the objective was around 1,800 yards. That's quite a long way. The 6th North Ants, they weren't in the initial assault. They were in support of the 12th Middlesex, and they had the 7th Bedfords that were in reserve. And this attack was to take place at lunchtime. At 1 o'clock p.m., the leading companies began to go forward, and at the same time, a heavy enemy barrage began to fall on the BEF's communication trenches, and in particular, the battalion headquarters, which was situated at a place called Campbell's Post. Now, there was one shell that burst just 2 yards from the 6th Battalion's headquarters. It caused three casualties, including a Captain Evans and a 2nd Lieutenant Bailey. So they made the decision to move the headquarters further forward in an effort to avoid the constant shelling, which, of course, would cause so many casualties and disrupt the planning for what was about to happen. But that turned into being, it caught in hindsight, a disastrous decision, because there was a man called Colonel Ripley. And he was a man that was revered and loved by the men of the North Ants. If we listen to all of the tales that came out during the 1960s in particular, You would think that all of these colonels and generals were hated by their men, and if we wanted evidence that that was a load of rubbish, really, Ripley is a prime example, because we've got documentary evidence of how much the men loved their commanding officer. So who was that commanding officer? George Ripley. He was born in Norfolk in 1864, so that makes him 53 years old when he was leading the Northamptons on that day. And after serving with the Norfolk Regiment, he joined the Northants in 1889 with the rank of captain. He served with the Northamptons during the South African Boer War, and he was twice mentioned in dispatches. In South Africa, he held the reputation amongst his men as a fearless leader, and not to say on occasions a bit of a daredevil. But in all he did, he showed the ability as an officer of experience. He then went back to his home at Cottingham in Northamptonshire, not far from Corby. He was given a great ovation from the local residents, who had watched his career at the front with great interest. And he remarks that the Northampton men, treated the right way, would always be found to be a grand lot of soldiers and an honour to the country. So when war broke out in 1914, he needn't have bothered. He could have just continued in his retirement or perhaps helped with the training of soldiers back home. But oh no, not this man. He at once applied to command his old battalion, and then he joined as commanding officer of the 6th Battalion. And to his joy, this was one of the first of the county's Kitchener battalions, the first volunteers to go to the Western Front. In January, he was mentioned by Sir John French in dispatches, and in March, he was wounded in the shoulder and came back to Northamptonshire to recuperate. And before leaving for the front again, he made a special journey to Northampton to thank the readers of the local paper and their generosity in keeping his men supplied with every requirement for their comfort. The people of Northampton were sending things over like socks to keep the men comfortable in the wet trenches. The colonel, it says in the Northampton Independent, deeply appreciated the way in which his battalion received a continuous stream of gifts. In 1896, Ripley had married a lady called Violet, and they had 2 sons and 1 daughter. So what happened to him on that day before the attack took place, and how did it affect the 6th Battalion? Well, as we know, the headquarters had moved slightly forward towards the front line. They thought they were going to be able to avoid the German shellfire that was coming in, but they didn't. And a shell hit Ripley and some other officers, hit by the same shell they were, and he was severely wounded and obviously evacuated from the trenches and taken to a casualty clearing station. From there, he made his way back to the UK, but his arm had to be amputated, and he was critical, but then he was rapidly improving, and there was every hope that he was going to successfully recover. But then, sadly, whilst in hospital in London, he was still healing well, but tetanus came along, his heart failed, and he sadly died. And this is how he was described in the Northampton Independent. The reason for Ripley's hold over those under his command is not far to seek. He obtained their wholehearted devotion by the fact that he was courageous, considerate, and scrupulously fair, unswervingly strict in discipline. He nevertheless exercised his authority more paternally than professionally, and while no man attempted to take a liberty with him, no man was afraid to consult him. Those under his command knew only one fear, that they should lose his confidence. The thought of his pride in them added to their strength and fired their flagging energy at times when only moral comfort could steady their shattered nerves. It was their thought of his pride that sustained them in smashing their way through Trones Wood. It was their readiness to follow in anywhere that gave them superhuman courage in storming and capturing the German stronghold which the enemy proclaimed to be impregnable. Their regret when they realised that he had been desperately wounded was profound. Their sorrow at his death will be deep and enduring, for they've lost an exemplary and untiring friend whom they will mourn with a sense of personal loss. His death is a serious matter for the county regiment, which can ill afford to lose a personality so potent and popular. And then after his death, his body was brought back to Cottingham in Northamptonshire, where his wife had him buried. He's not buried beneath the Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. The family chose a private memorial. And there was a poem written about George, and it reads like this. In him, the England that he loved had bred, a gentleman, a true and noble son, content to do his work and leave it done, proud that for England he'd fought and bled. So he has passed, defying age and foes, serene and fearless, foremost in the line, and from our midst a trusted comrade goes, whose memory the Shire will e'er sun enshrine. Engraven there his name will ever be, for death has brought him immortality. So what a disastrous start to the battle that day. But they weren't to be put off, those men. Most of them, of course, perhaps wouldn't have known what had happened at this stage. So which direction were they attacking from, that 18th Division? Well, not up the hill, not from Ortwill Wood. Most people, when they go to Teepvale, they go down to the Cross of Sacrifice, and they look down the hill towards Ortwill Wood, and that's the way the attack came, the disastrous attack on the first day of the Somme. But not on this day, not on the 26th of September, because if you walk back up to the memorial through the two cemeteries, the Commonwealth and French cemeteries, and then go beyond the memorial and look from the gravel path, turn right, there's some flagpoles, and in the distance you can see the trees of the Leipzig redoubt, and that's the direction that the Northampton men came, a flanking attack on this day, taking the Germans by surprise. The preliminary bombardment had lasted for 3 days, and 60,000 rounds of field artillery were fired, along with 45,000 rounds of the heavier shells from the Royal Garrison Artillery. And then the British unleashed gas on the 24th of September against Teepvale. And 0 hour was set for 12:35, with the Northampton cheers going in at 1 o'clock, 25 minutes later, and that allowed 4 hours of daylight before the advancing troops would consolidate under the cover of growing darkness. It would mean that the Germans wouldn't be able to retaliate. And into battle they went, supporting the Royal Fusiliers and the 12th Middlesex. And between them, they managed to secure Teepvale that day. What was left of the church, the village, and of course the old chateau were all taken. And by 11 o'clock at night, the whole of the divisional objectives had been achieved and also consolidated. And the next morning, the men were relieved. It's always difficult to assess casualties. We'll look at the British casualties later. But the Northamptons thought that the German losses were such as 606 other ranks had surrendered, and that the amount of Germans killed or wounded was in excess of 3,000. The divisional commander, General Ivor Max, we mentioned him earlier, he'd been watching the battle from a distance, and afterwards he placed it on record. He said that the outstanding feature of the advance of the Northamptonshire Regiment was the display of gallantry by its officers, who exposed themselves fearlessly to get their man forward through the innumerable shell holes. And it was at 5 o'clock that afternoon, what, 4 hours after the North Ants had gone into action, that the battered village of Teepvale was finally in the hands of the BEF. There was just one small corner of the village that was holding out. But of course, by this time, the North Ants, the Middlesex men and the Royal Fusiliers, they were absolutely exhausted, and they settled down for the night in front of the enemy stronghold. And it's said that the Germans resisted, those Germans that weren't killed or didn't give up, and resisted so stoutly is the word that they used, they had to be driven out by bayonet and a whirlwind of bombs. And the capture of Teepvale was considered to be so important that Earl Haig, the commander-in-chief of the BEF, he personally visited the troops the next day to congratulate them on their success. But it had been costly, it always is costly, isn't it? The Northamptons, their losses were, at that stage, recorded as 105 men killed or died of wounds, 235 were wounded, and 23 missing. And they were just the other ranks. When it comes to officers, there are 14 officers that were either killed or died of wounds. That's a tremendous amount. So before we go any further and look at what some of the Northampton men wrote, let's listen to one of those soldiers that went into the first wave with the Royal Fusiliers. Now, it's worth really listening carefully to what this man says, because he describes the attack from the moment of going into action, what it was like to jump into German trenches, to kill people, and then to clear the German dugouts, and what he did when the Germans wouldn't come out. He also then goes on to talk about British soldiers killing German prisoners of war and why they did that and how they felt, and also what they found in those German dugouts once they'd taken them, and compared them to the British dugouts And finally, he talks about losing friends, counting the casualties, and having his photo taken for the people back home. It's 7 minutes long, but it's such a clear account of what happened on that day. It's well worth a listen.
0 hour was at 12:35 p.m. 26 September. The officers compared watches and gave the order to advance. So we climbed out of our trenches and all hell was let loose. Shells crashed over and around us. Machine guns chattered as their fire swept to and fro across our path as we stumbled forward through no man's land, doubled up over the faint hope of dodging the bullets. We had been told not to budge together, as that would be an easy target. So from the first, each man was on his own. Here and there were men crumpled up in a shell hole, or reeling in agony, tangled up in barbed wire, some dead. The ground was uphill, and we did not have far to go to reach the German front line that had been smashed by our artillery fire, and where we found a few Germans. We shot anything that moved and dragged ourselves out over the parados onto the next trench. We had been told to make for the ruin of a chateau, and dazed and exhausted as I was, I dragged myself to a little hill where there was a pile of stones. All that was left of the chateau, I suppose. Here, a German machine gun fire became fiercer and ever, just sweeping above the ground. I threw myself into a shell hole and, seizing my chance as the bullets whistled over my head, I slid from shell hole to shell hole into a third German trench where some of our boys were held up. Hand-to-hand fighting followed, the Germans contesting every yard. Two of the officers were killed and another wounded. Eventually, the arrival of a Lewis gun team enabled us to clear the trench. This allowed us to get on with a special job our company had been given, mopping up the German dugouts, making sure there were no live Germans in them. An officer allotted each of us a number of dugouts to clear. Well, these dugouts had been well built, very different from our scratched out holes. Real engineering jobs, and many were intact, not touched by our shelling. They were 20 to 30 feet deep, and it was a perilous job tackling them. I started by shooting down them, telling any Germans left to come up. If there was no response, I fired a few shots and then threw down a Mills bomb. We got quite a few. Some came holding up their hands and shouting, "Kamerad!" Others held up photographs of their wives and children. We had to be very quick on them, for some still had a bit of fight in them. One dugout in particular contained a large number of Germans with a couple of machine guns, and since they could not be got out, a place was set on fire. Several were killed as they came out. The others died in the fire. The prisoners were sent back down the line in the charge of a corporal of escort, but many got shot on the way down. The escort told us later that many of our boys were mad with what they had gone through and the strain of it all, and just shot at anything in a German uniform. It was getting dark now, and although the firing seemed to have moved on, we were warned that there would probably be a German counterattack. So we started to get the trench ready to resist, building up the parados into a parapet facing the enemy. This meant heaving the German dread over the top. A gruesome job which covered us with blood. This done, we waited through the night. Some explored the dugouts that were found to be well stocked with drink and cigars, and came up wearing German helmets. Those who had them divided up their rations and tried to get a little sleep through sheer exhaustion. The counterattack never came, and next morning we were relieved. So we drifted back in small parties to find a small group that had set up on the road with dixies of hot soup. We asked after our friends who had got a blighty one and who had become a landowner. Then the official photographer came along, and for the benefit of those at home, we had to put on a cheerfulness which we were far from feeling.
So going back to the six Northamptons, I've got an account here that was written after the war by Private 14597 F.B. Howe. He says, our next treat was a special march back to the Somme at Tietville. Before we arrived, there'd been five previous attempts made to capture it without success. In the area around were a number of sunken roads with dugouts built into the banks. Near us was a bridge, and running alongside a sunken road was the river. It being lovely summer weather in a few days prior to the attack, we took the opportunity to bathe in the river. As there was occasional shelling, we had to keep a sharp lookout, but when things began to really hot up, the river was placed out of bounds. I think what he's talking about there is around Ortwil, behind the original British lines from the 1st of July, because he's talking about the Ankh River that is in the valley behind the village of Ortwil, where the beautiful cemetery is now. He goes on with his account. He says, 2 days before the attack, the first tanks of the war were tried out beside us, and these were also used to help when we went over. The general promised us that if we took our objective, we'd be relieved within 24 hours, and this promise was kept. Unfortunately, Colonel Ripley was severely wounded and later died in hospital. At the time he was wounded, he was in a trench with the adjutant when there was heavy shelling. Both the colonel and the adjutant were big men, about 16 stone each, so there was insufficient room for the colonel to pass the adjutant in the trench where he was hit. As it so happened, the adjutant was also a casualty, and after Tietville, we were given a rest. So now what I'm going to do is turn once again to Richard Van Emden's book. He calls The Somme, The Epic Battle, in the Soldier's Own Words and Photographs. I've used Richard's book before, and I really do recommend, if you've got a copy of this, turn to page 266 and 267, and in the pages around there, because there's lots of photographs that were taken by British soldiers showing the battlefield in and around Tietville on that day, both before and after the battle. There's some horrendous photographs of some of the Germans lying dead in the trenches as well. I'm not going to reproduce those on the website. It's not fair to Richard. Just recommend that people get that book. It's readily available in all the usual places. But in the book, Richard uses an account by a man called Sidney Fuller, who was with the 8th Battalion of the Suffolk Regiment. And he wrote an extremely graphic description of what happened that day. He says, the 26th of September got ready and moved up towards the front line at dawn. Each man carried on his back a lozenger-shaped piece of bright tin cut from a biscuit tin, about 8 inches by 6. These were worn so that our artillery observers could accurately observe the extent of our advance. There was much delay, and we waited in Joseph Trench and again in Hindenburg Trench for some time. In the latter trench, we were stopped for some time opposite the half-buried and putrefying remains of an English soldier. Very nice too, just before we went over the top. We eventually reached the forward assembly trench about 10 o'clock a.m. It was a lovely day, bright and warm. Our guns were fairly quiet all morning. A big howitzer was firing into Teepval, and huge splinters from the shells kept buzzing over our trench, which, being a newly dug one, was also very good cover. We were just beside the remains of a solitary hawthorn bush. To the right of us, we could not see much, but to the left, the ground rose rather sharply, and we could see many of our men in the continuation of the trench that we were in. We were told that the barrage would commence at 12:35 p.m, and we were not to fix our bayonets until then, in case the enemy saw them glitter in the sun and they rumbled us. We wanted the attack to be a surprise one if possible. The rum was issued, the guns remained very quiet, and only a few enemy shells came over, dropping some distance over us. A few minutes before 0 hour, the order was passed along the trench, "Fix your bayonets!" Then, at what was, according to our watch, half a minute or more to 12:35 p.m, 4 18-pounder guns fired. 1, 2, 3, 4, and in a few seconds all the hundreds of guns behind us were firing. The barrage dropped just in front of us, so close that the 18-pounder shells seemed only to skim our trench, and for a few minutes I found it difficult not to keep ducking. What he's talking about here, of course, is the creeping barrage. He then says the first wave went over immediately, then the second, then the third, all at a few seconds interval, and then the fourth, which included D Company headquarters and ourselves. The noise made by the guns was a continual thundering roar, very different to the 1st of July. And a minute before, we could have whispered to one another, now we had to shout in each other's ears if we wanted to speak. The barrage was like a wall of smoke and dust, topped by the white smoke from the shrapnel shells. It was now 200 yards away and was slowly creeping forward in front of our first wave. A slight wind was blowing the smoke away from us very nicely. Away we went at a steady walk, carrying our rifles at the high port, bayonet pointing upwards and to the left so as to avoid accidentally spiking one of our own men. The trenches were silent and motionless. Then suddenly, at the appointed minute, the slopes of Teepval seemed to move with small brown figures like a field alive with rabbits, and the guns swept down on Teepval and the country to the right of it. At first the men advanced in disordered masses, but gradually, taking their own time, they opened out like a stage crowd falling into their allocated places. I could see the first wave walking towards Teepval, and then a second wave sprang up and spread out behind them, and then the last wave took shape and followed up in artillery formation. Small bunches of men, with an interval between each bunch, or more than six men advancing in single file with a stretcher bearer in the rear. It was a wonderful sight. Never have I seen such a calm, methodical and perfectly ordered advance. It seemed incredible that this parade could be marching on Teepval, the most sinister of German strongholds, yet hardly a man fell. The barrage was as perfect as it was terrible. The white smoke of shrapnel rang like a rampart along the trenches that were the first objective, a clear as though it were made of tape, carefully placed and measured. From my vantage point, I could even look over the barrage into the trenches beyond, but it was hard even for a moment to drag one's eyes away from the little brown figures that were slowly but steadily drawing upon Teepval. He then continues with his description. He said, I saw men stop like a cigarette and walk on again as if walking down a street. There did not seem to be many bullets flying about us, but no doubt the noise of the guns prevented us from hearing them. We'd not got far when a huge shell burst 15 yards behind us and to the right. I did not hear it coming, although it must have been about an 11-inch calibre. We were almost knocked down by the explosion, but were unhurt. A man just in front of me was hit by one of the splinters, was entered his right side and stopped under the skin in the centre of his chest, making a big lump there like a large boil. We paused in a shell hole to bandage him up as well as we could. In the same shell hole, there was another man who'd been shot through the calf of a leg, a nice, cushy one. We went on again over the enemy's front line, which had been taken away easily. Shortly afterwards, we had to stop again. A part of the enemy were putting up a desperate resistance in a piece of communication trench around a dugout. They were firing away at our men who had passed them. Our support company came up and soon cleared them out, shooting the riflemen first and then bombing the dugout, down which the survivors had bolted. We forgot our own company for the time being and watched the fight, waiting our chance to take a hand. Two of the enemy were lying dead on the top of the dugout entrances, wearing their steel helmets and equipment, and with their rifles under them, just as they had died, riddled with bullets. Another was lying buried almost to the neck by a shell which had dropped near, but still alive. I shall never forget the expression on this man's face, ghastly white, his eyes staring with terror, unable to move, while our chaps threw bombs past him, down the dugout stairs, and the enemy inside threw their bombs out. The explosions of the bombs in the dugouts could be felt rather than heard. We could feel the shock of the explosion, but the sound was deadened by the depth of the dugout. One little German popped out wearing his steel helmet, holding both hands above his head and crying, "Mercy, mercy." He was shot at once and dropped like an empty sack. And Fuller continues, or he ends his account by saying that several of the captured enemy dugouts were burning fiercely, having been set fire by the bombs. Many of these dugouts evidently had in them stores of enemy bombs or ammunition, for from time to time one or another would blow up like a small mine, hurling timber high into the air. After lying out for about 2.5 hours, we began to get back to Zollern Trench, going one at a time because of the sniping of the enemy. I found that my companion Bobby had gone to sleep, and I had to wake him up by prodding him with the toe of my boot. I went back to the trench first and arrived safely. Fritz was a bad shot and only hit the ground. I then watched Bob make a bolt for it. He started off all right, but before reaching the trench, he was attacked by cramp in the legs and had to stop in a shell hole, coming in later. So as we know, the Germans retreated from the Somme area in the spring of 1917. And what I found now is an account from an officer that visited Tietvau in the spring or the summer of 1917. And he describes what the battlefield looked like at this stage. And he also talks about the search for one of his friends that he knew had been killed at Tietvau. And he must have gone as far as Ovile Cemetery, just over the hill away from Tietvau, because he talks about finding the grave of Harry Launder, one of the famous graves that sits within that cemetery at Ovile. So let me explain in his own words exactly what he found.
In about the April and May of 1917, we had got well back into where the Somme fighting had pushed back to, and I had a chance to go over to Tietvau when we were out at rest for a few days, and I was able to get away. And so I took the chance to go to Tietvau across this simply desolated country where everything had been wiped out. We had been doing practice attacks in various sorts of trench layouts in training for continuing this pushing on. And we came across some pretty dreadful patches where the worst of the fighting had been. When I came back, I told people I had never seen anything quite so dreadful as this place, Tietvau. I went on the ration lorry to where there was a railhead where supplies came up, and then I went down a little railway that was used for bringing supplies down this valley of the little river Ancre. And there, all on the eastern side of it, there was a great steep rise of hill with everything blasted to bits. I got out at the nearest station to where I hoped to find Teepval by the map, and I asked the rail transport man in charge which is the way to Teepval. Teepval, he said, there ain't no such place. There was, I know, but it's wiped out. But he said, if you go up that road up there, up the side of the hill, you'll come to a crossroad. You can just make it out where there's a broken down tank. And alongside of that, you'll see a reddish colored mound. Well, that was the chateau. It was built of red brick. And it was so pounded down to rubble that that's all you can see of it by its colour. And therefore, oh, as far as you could see along this hillside, there were the groups and, oh, scores and scores of the little wooden crosses that had been put up where people had been buried, wherever they could be buried. And I went around. I'd gone with the idea of wondering whether I might find any record of this friend of mine. But, oh, all the regiments in the British Army nearly, and seemed hopeless to find one. The only name I saw, just by chance, I came on Captain John Lauder, Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. Well, that was Harry Lauder's son, the old comedian who was doing a show in London and had been doing it, a show called Three Cheers, in 1916, about cheering people on for when everybody came home again. And he was doing that when his son was killed. But he kept on with the show, and I saw him sometime afterwards. Magnificent to see him the way he kept on. But that was not far from Teepval, but all the place. There are little villages, every mile or so. There were the remains of some village, but everything blasted to bits. And so I just looked around. I saw I couldn't do anything. I found some people, disabled officers, who were given the job of doing some sorting out and recording. So I gave them particulars, and they said, well, if we do find this name, we'll let you know. That was all I could do, except that the Flanders poppy, all over this place, those poppies had sprung up.
So let's now have a look at one or two of those casualties from the men that fell that day. And the first one is one of the officers that was a casualty, Second Lieutenant Herbert Haywood. He lived with his family at number 9 Ketching Road in Northampton, which is virtually in the town centre. And the local paper reports that he was about 20 years old and before enlisting was a very successful scholar at the Northampton Town and County School, having taken a scholarship at one of the universities for mathematics. He was a good athlete, he was a fine footballer, cricketer and a runner, and his death will be regretted by many of the old and present scholars at the school. The local Northampton paper also reports of a Mr. Arnold Brown, the youngest son of the Reverend Dr. Charles Brown from Clipston in Northamptonshire, has been killed in action. Mr. Brown had been through some of the fiercest fighting in the war and was amongst the troops that entered Teepval. At the beginning of the war, he was a student at Bristol College, and the highest hopes were entertained for his future career. Dr. Brown has 3 other sons that are in the army. It's always the same, isn't it? They always talk about what would their sons have turned into, what would they have achieved in their lives had they not been killed on the Somme and in other theatres, in other battlefields of the Great War. We'll never know, of course. Such is the tragedy. Another man who died that day, but wasn't an officer, was just a normal cobbler, was Corporal Fred Archer from Rushton. He worked for Mr. George Selwood, a boot manufacturer in Rushton. He enlisted, volunteered in August of 1915, and he arrived in France in March 1916 and was there for 6 months before he died on those slopes at Teepvale. And the local paper in Northampton also reports on some of the men that were wounded that day. They managed to get this man here, Harold Valentin. He managed to get what's known as a blighty, a wound that was serious enough for him to be evacuated from the trenches, but not necessarily life-changing. It says that he was the son of Mr. and Mrs. Valentine of Stoke Bruin, and he was wounded in the left arm by a bullet on September the 26th. He's now in hospital at Chatham. He's 23 years old. Before he joined the army in September, he was employed at St. Andrew's Hospital in Moulton Park. And he joined the 8th Northants in August of 1915, and then he was transferred to the 6th Battalion. So he came home. But a man who didn't, who's reported on the same page, is Private Ton Warner. He came from Great Billing in Northampton. He was 21 years of age. He volunteered at the outbreak of war and was formerly employed by Messrs. Valentine's in Adnet Road of Northampton. And then there was Lance Corporal J. Fletcher. He'd formerly worked at Crockett and Jones in Northampton. They were one of the shoe factories that produced so many of the boots for the men that fought on the Western Front from not just Britain but our allies. And Crockett, the family Crockett, gave up two sons that died in the war. And he was engaged to a Miss Kimball of Lincoln Street. One brother is serving in the Royal Field Artillery, and another has recently been discharged from the Northamptonshire Regiment. There's no real science to what I'm doing here. I'm just going through the papers and just picking out names of ordinary men that died in and around Teepvale on that day, or lives were changed forever, perhaps, like one of them that we just talked about, they were wounded. No real science to this at all. Just trying to remember ordinary men that went off to fight for our country all those years ago. Now here's one on the same page. It's talking about a Private George Westnut, who was serving with the Durham Light Infantry. Now, I'm not sure this has necessarily got anything to do with Teepvale, but I just noticed this on the page. And the family knew he was missing. They didn't know what had happened to him until they received a letter from a Lieutenant Gameson from the Royal Army Medical Corps. And he said that whilst on a visit to the frontline trenches, he found the body of Private Westnut. He was shot through the head and must have been killed instantaneously. He'd been reported missing. He also writes, "It will pride you to know that your son was killed in the very front of the advance, just outside a village that was captured." Westnut was 26 and worked at Page & Sons in Wellingborough. And he was the second son that his mum had lost during the war. His brother, Private T. Westnut, had been killed in October of 1914. But he could have been one of those men that was forever missing, but he wasn't. That kind man from the Royal Army Medical Corps took the time to write home and tell that poor man's parents that their son had actually been found. He was no longer one of the missing. And thankfully, he does have a known grave. He's one of those men that's buried in the Wallencourt British Cemetery, which is on the main road between Albert and Bapaume. Whenever you go to the Somme, you'll pass this cemetery. It's in the shadow of the Butte de Wallencourt. Now, you don't have to take my word for it that the Northamptons and the men from the 18th Division were there at Teepvale, because there's evidence. When you go, as people do, to the Teepvale Memorial, it's one of the highlights of your visits to the Somme. As you walk up the steps to the Stone of Remembrance, look to the right through the piers, through the panels, through the trees, and then in the distance at the end of the tree line, you'll see a memorial. So when you've finished at Teepvale, go back to your car, leave the car park and turn left, and just a few yards away on the right-hand side, you'll see this functional but very important memorial. It's not far from where the ruins of the chateau were, where so many of those Northampton men fell. And it's often overlooked after people have been to see the Tietze Owl Memorial. They're normally tired, maybe a little bit overcome by what they've seen at Tietze Owl. And people drive past this memorial, but it's worth stopping. On the front of the memorial are the words, "To the glory of God and in imperishable memory of the officers, NCOs and men of the 18th Division who fell in the Great War, 1914 to 1918. And then the lists all of the division's battle honours, and it also lists the units within their brigades that made up the division. It's not the only memorial to the 18th Division on the Somme, because as we said earlier, just a few weeks before, in mid-July, they'd taken Trones Wood, and there's a memorial to the division there. And of course, on one of those plaques on the side of the memorial, it mentions the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment, to whom this podcast is dedicated. And the final word will go, we've talked about tributes given to the North Ants and the 18th Division by the divisional commander. Well, the commander going further up the chain of command of the 2nd Corps was a Lieutenant General C.W. Jacobs. And he said, "Tietze Owl has withstood all attacks upon it for exactly 2 years. And it is a great honour to have captured the whole of this strongly fortified village at the first attempt. Heavy congratulations to you all." So there we go. What a remarkable story of planning, leadership, tactics, versatility. You name it, everything worked at Tietze Owl. Finally, Tietze Owl has fallen to the BEF. And I wonder whether people think about that when we go there. I always do, obviously coming from Northampton. But when we go to Tietze Owl, we look at the 72,000 names on the memorial, everyone telling a story, everyone has a story. And we wander around there and, you know, I've heard people using words like futility and disaster and the loss, which of course it was, you know, there's no getting away from that. But it did fall in the end. And it fell on that one day, on the 26th of September. It was fought over again in the summer of 1918, briefly, when finally it was taken for the last time. And, which is another story, the Germans came back to Tietze Owl in 1940, and the area was occupied for 4 years by the Nazis. And there's evidence with photos of Germans sitting on the wall at the back of the memorial, looking out across the Anglo-French cemetery. But that's a podcast for another day. Today it was all about those men from Northamptonshire, from the Royal Fusiliers, from other eastern counties that took the bastion, the fortress, the impregnable Tietze Owl in September of 1916. And next week we'll be back with another podcast with a special guest next week. A lot of people I know that listen to this podcast are sports fans. And we've got one of England's greatest sportsmen coming on next week, in my view anyway, a bit biased. But his name is Jack Russell. He played cricket for England in the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s. And he's got a very special connection with the Great War, with his relative that died at the First Battle of Ypres. And I went to see him a couple of days ago and we recorded an extremely emotional interview. As people will know, Jack has moved on from his cricket career and he's now a fantastic painter and artist. And he painted, after visiting the battlefields, a wonderful canvas showing his great uncle going into action and looking over his shoulder and looking back. And that was the day he died in action. And Jack has called that painting Seconds from Hell. And he talks about that with great love and emotion. And that'll be out next week, sometime next week. But that's it for now. As usual, I'd like to end the podcast by playing the last post in memory of all of those men from the 18th Division that died at Tietze Owl. But in particular, their much loved and missed commanding officer, George Ripley. Thank you for listening.